Arnold Schwarzenegger is the soft grey hemisphere that sits between our ears. The human brain is a masterpiece of evolution, but it does complicate our lives. And nowhere is this more apparent than when we struggle with the big questions of sex and death. It could be said that the trouble started with Aristotle, who believed that each sex act had a direct life-shortening effect. We see many centuries later this troubling idea surfacing in the work of the metaphysical poets. It would be hard to find gloomier expression than John Donne's mournful musing. Since each such act, they say, diminisheth the length of life a day, I'll no more dote and run to pursue things which hath in damaged me. Now, if you were to ask the male praying mantis, being eaten by his bride during the act of copulation, whether the metaphysical poets were correct that the orgasm is a little death, he would probably agree. He might even drop the word little. You might get the same answer from the Pacific salmon, which spawns but once and dies. But is it true of you and me? Does sex shorten our lives? Can it be, as some have suggested, that aging and death are the price we pay for sex? Does it make sense to think in terms of a reproductive duty to the species, leaving us surplus to requirement when duty is done? And what, if these worrying notions are true, are we to make of the postmenopausal woman? These are the questions that I shall examine in today's lecture, and I shall hope to show you that the answers are not only reassuring on the whole, but also that they tell us a great deal about the biological background to our revolution in longevity. In fact, Aristotle was right. There is a relationship between sex and death. But it's even more interesting than Aristotle suspected. The catalytic insight came in 1881 from the distinguished German naturalist August Weismann. What Weismann realized was that in a multicellular body like yours and mine, there's a profound division of labor between two principal kinds of cells. On the one hand, there's the germline, the egg or sperm-forming cells of the ovary or testis. These are the cells that, if we have children, transmit our genes into the next generation. The rest of the cells, those that make up the other organs of the body, Weismann termed the soma. In the early stages of life on planet Earth, before the distinction between germline and somatic cells evolved, the responsibility for generating new individuals was shared by every cell. Indeed, most organisms were probably unicellular, and their descendants are with us today, bacteria, amoebae, and the like. But as cells came to live in clumps of genetically identical clones, the separation of germline and soma offered wonderful new opportunities for some of the cells, freed from the need to support procreation, to become specialists. In our bodies today, we find red blood cells specialized for transporting oxygen and other constituents around the body. We find white blood cells designed to police the body for intruders and destroy them. We find brain and nerve cells engineered for the conduction of electrical signals. We find the cells of the lens of the eye uniquely translucent in order to transmit and focus light upon the retina. It would be hard to imagine how such diverse specialisms could be supported if each of the cells needed also to retain the capacity to produce a new baby. The distinction between germline and soma enabled such extraordinary advances in the evolution of the higher forms of life that we might almost forgive the terrible price that we have paid. For it was this, not sex, that caused us to age and die. There are species that age and don't have sex, like parthenogenetic whiptail lizards. And there are species that have sex and don't age, like the freshwater hydra. Although hydra are capable of sex, they don't often bother and make do instead with vegetative reproduction by budding. Almost any part of a hydra can generate a new individual,